Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Karen Kelski of The Professor Is In. And before we get started, I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsors. And our sponsors are you, the listeners. You keep us on air, and we are very grateful to those of you who have become supporting members of our podcast. If you haven't yet, then you too can pay $3.99 a month and support the podcast and help us pay the people who keep it going. And to do that, go to bit.ly/ourpod. That's bit.ly/OURPOD. And you will find out all the information and find a way to sign up. Members get access to a special membership page. They get a free webinar recording every month, AMAs, and all kinds of other perks and access to live conversations on our podcast member page. So please do join us. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Kel Weinhold from The Professor's In, productivity coach, interview, intervention, support person for you in your academic job search, and very excited that you're here today.
And I am Dr. Karen Kelski of The Professor Is In, and I'm delighted you're here with us today. And today we are beyond thrilled to have a guest with us. Her name is Fobazi Itar, and I'm going to ask Fobazi to introduce herself, but I do want to point out that Fobazi works in the fields of librarianship as well as activism, and Fobazi wrote several pieces on the concept of vocational awe. And we're going to be talking about that concept, how it intersects between librarianship and academia, and the ways that it plays into making this quasi-religious world in which nobody should ever ask to be appropriately compensated because it's a religious calling. Fobazi, welcome.
Hello, everyone. My name is Fobazi Itar. I am an independent scholar, activist, and librarian, and ironically, to what we will be talking about, I will be starting my PhD program at the iSchool at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign coming this fall.
Great. And so give us some background. What in your background led you to get to the point of writing your piece about vocational awe and your sort of larger critique of the politics of librarianship?
Yes, I think that it's important to note that I am a pastor's kid. My mom is a pastor. And so I grew up living, breathing, just everything was the church. Mm-hmm. Regardless of if I was in the church building or not, everything revolved around God and religion and being a member of the church. And so growing up, I am just used to tying everything to a religious concept or seeing religiosity in everything. That is basically what pastors do. They take their experiences in their everyday lives and they connect it to whatever concept in Christianity that they are talking about for the congregation or whomever. Seeing the religious undertones of things is not something new to me. And when I started library school, I very quickly noticed that there was a sense of religiosity, just underpinning all of the lessons that I learned throughout library school. And it continued into the field. As I would go to conferences and do professional development, the idea that librarianship was a calling was not only common, but almost taught to us to believe that librarianship is something that is a higher state of being almost. And so the turning point for me, or the catalyst for starting to explore this more, was a particular conference that I went to. It was a panel of librarians who worked with youth and teens. I was a school librarian at the time working at a middle school. And so I came to this panel to learn how to better work with teens. And one of the panelists mentioned that working with youth, working with teen and children was a sacred duty. And not only that, but if you didn't believe that it was a sacred duty, that you should not be in librarianship at all, mm-hmm. which was astonishing to me. Mm-hmm. And so this was, again, the catalyst to lead me to start thinking, well, why is it that we're using such strong religious language for something that in essence is a job, is a profession? And so it was through this research that I came up with the concept of vocational awe.
Mm-hmm. So can you give me, Karen was reading your work to me as I was trying to set everything up, but can you give me just a primer on how you define vocational awe?
Of course. So vocational awe describes the set of ideas, values, and assumptions that librarians have about themselves and the profession that result in notions that libraries as institutions are inherently good and sacred and therefore beyond critique. Mm-hmm. So that's the simplest definition. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important to note that it's not the idea that that libraries are good. I think most people would agree that libraries are a good institution. It's the idea that it is inherently good and sacred and therefore beyond critique, mm-hmm. that critiquing libraries, or as we'll talk about later, academia, mm-hmm. is somehow immoral because the right. institution itself is inherently good and sacred.
Yeah. You do two really interesting things in your work. On the one hand, you talk about martyrdom as not being a viable career path, and that martyrdom will not pay your rent, martyrdom, you can't eat martyrdom, you have to seek adequate compensation for what is in the end a job. And yet seeking adequate compensation, as you say somewhere in this article, I don't actually have it pulled up in front of me, but seeking a reasonable lunch break, it seems so petty when the work is involving, you know, huge moral issues of knowledge and so on. So that's one direction. But the other direction you go in, which I think is even more important, is that when you make the institution above critique, that means that you absolutely conceal or avoid or gaslight the fact to which libraries are institutions of white supremacy. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that latter part.
So librarianship itself, especially when we're talking about Western constructions of libraries, were built around this idea of democratic access to information. The idea that anyone and everyone can go to the library, regardless of race, gender, class, whatever it might be, and gain the same access to information. And so when we're talking about it being beyond critique, it's the brushing under of all of the very real negative things that libraries have done. One big example that I always use is the fact that libraries were segregated. Like schools, like other institutions, there were Black libraries and white libraries. And during integration, libraries were also dealing with instances of Black students, Black people protesting the separate but equal by trying to go into the white spaces. Hmm. A famous example being the Tougaloo Nine, who went into the main library at Tougaloo College and were subsequently arrested for doing so. And when we talk about segregated libraries, rather, when we don't talk about segregated libraries, we also forget to mention that libraries, for the most part, in the North and the South, rather than integrate, close. They just shut the library down and refuse to serve anyone.
Huh.
And
I didn't know that.
Yes, it was a very common occurrence throughout the southern states, and it also did happen in the northern states. Again, this is not just the, oh, it only happens right. in the South right, thing. Right. Or if they did integrate, what they would do, kind of reminiscent of what we're doing with COVID, they would take all the chairs and all the tables away so that it would prevent people wanting to linger and therefore mixing of these groups. Wow. And so there, again, despite there was never really a time where libraries were in fact open to all. Even now, although most libraries are integrated, we have just changed the policies to marginalize groups in different ways, whether it be by forcing patrons to have a valid license in order to access the materials, whether it's by enforcing ID rules inequitably, you know, where oftentimes Black and Brown students and even university libraries or in the public libraries, the security guard or whomever is manning the desk mm-hmm. will ask Black and Brown students for their IDs because they don't believe that they're students or that they're a part of the community way more often than they will for white patrons of the community.
So this sounds, this move from segregated to we're just going to shut it down, which I know also happened with swimming pools and in a number of other places, like, okay, then not at all. And then creating a supposedly integrated space that then are all these barriers to access to that space. Sounds to me like the larger universities as well. I mean, it's I feel like we see the same kind of structural issues and gaslighting of, oh, it's open to everyone in within the just the university institution and then the library within that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that when I wrote Vocational Awe, I am a librarian. I was on the tenure track for a academic library job. And so that was the space that I was writing within. But I definitely see Vocational Awe in various institutions, in various fields, academia, of course, being a major one, that idea that the pursuit of knowledge is something open to everyone. And in fact, oftentimes philosophers would call libraries the people's university. Mm-hmm. The idea that, like the university, everyone can come and seek knowledge ignores all of the structural barriers in place to marginalize patrons who belong to all of these groups with marginalizations.
Mm-hmm. You recently wrote about your colleague, LaTanya, and mm-hmm. and the role. And then I actually was just on your blog and noticed that your most recent post is where you talked about, in some ways, as a result of her experience, you've decided to go on and get your PhD. Is that right? Could you talk to us a little bit about what happened with LaTanya, what you wrote about her, and how that's informing what you're going to do in your own future studies?
Yes, from 2015 to 2017, I was a librarian at Temple University. It was a 2-year term limited position, and LaTanya was my colleague and also my mentor at Temple. She, like me, is a Black woman. Temple has a lot of Black students. Unfortunately, librarianship is very white as a profession for academic libraries. It's about 85% white and female. Mm-hmm. For the K-12 space, it's actually 92% white and female.
Whoa.
Yes. So it is, LaTanya and I connected very quickly, just being one of the, you know, 10% of Black librarians in the field. And another reason that we connected is that we both were dealing with the, what I call inhumane and honestly barbaric sick leave policy that Temple has for its workers. And so basically, we as faculty gain 10 sick days in a 12-month period. However, if you use more than 6 sick days, paid or unpaid, within that 12-month period, you start to accrue disciplinary actions that ramp up all the way up to termination. And again, this is paid or unpaid. So even if you run out of the sick days you've accrued, each separate sick day that you take afterward is a separate violation. So it starts off with verbal warnings, then written warnings, then 3-day suspensions, and then termination is how the policy goes. Wow. Yes.
I can't even. There's a lot that... Nothing about the university shocks me much anymore, but I can't even, okay, I'm not going to interrupt you. I'm just having trouble wrapping my mind around it, but sorry, go ahead.
Yes, trust me, I am right there with you. So even though you are given sick days,
you can't use them without a penalty. Them.
Yes.
Okay. Really. That's the part my mind is just having it, like, it's like the gears are going, but okay.
And so I have sickle cell anemia. It is a chronic illness and it causes chronic pain, chronic fatigue, as well as frequent hospitalizations. It is federally protected by the ADA as a disability. And LaTanya had been diagnosed with cancer maybe a year or so before I met her. And so she was going through rounds of chemo at the time. And so we would talk about the ways that we would try and deal with policy. We as librarians were only allowed 1 day a week to work from home. It takes 2 years to gain that privilege to get 1 day a week. And seeing as I was term limited to 2 years, I of course was never able to actually gain that privilege. Mm-hmm. But yes, we are only allowed 1 day a week to work from home. And if you don't come in for at least 4 hours, that still counts as half a sick day, which would then go towards the disciplinary actions. Mm-hmm. And so what would end up happening is that she would have to come in to work after chemo or get penalized for taking the day off, mm-hmm. basically. And, you know, as we all know, chemo, it causes nausea, fatigue, just general body aches. It's a brutal process to try and recover from cancer. And so for me, like, sickle cell often ends up with hospitalizations. And so even just one hospitalization could potentially wipe out all 6 days that I would have for the year. And then again, not only would the sick days I would need to take afterwards be unpaid, but I was additionally penalized for taking said sick days. And so, unfortunately, in America, health insurance is very much tied to employment. And so the juggling of trying to take care of yourself, but also making sure that you come into work was just incredibly stressful. Mm-hmm. And she unfortunately recently passed away from cancer. And it just, to me, it shows the extreme nature of vocational awe. The idea that loving our job is so important that we would put everything else on the line for it. And the institutions and, you know, the idea is do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. But these institutions, unfortunately, don't love us back. Mm-hmm. We are expected to live and breathe and work for them and make sure we're physically in the building. But, you know, Temple University is going to go on and replace, you know, that's now an open job position, which will be replaced by someone else. And then the cycle will start all over again. And so I think, you know, it might seem like it doesn't make sense that I would, in some ways, dedicate my PhD journey to her. But for me, what I see it as is this research that I'm doing needs to be seen by as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. And the name of the game, unfortunately, is that a PhD just opens a lot of doors. I want to be able to be knowledgeable about this research that I'm doing so that I can speak to as many different people as possible about how we as Americans see work and that sort of puritanical mm-hmm. underpinnings of what value and productivity means for a person's identity.
I was thinking just recently about how the U.S. is at its core so litigious that it assumes that you are in each situation, there assumes that you're trying to get away with something, steal something, not live up to that. Like there's a, you know, if we go to the religious element, there's sort of an inherent sin quality to it that you need to be constantly monitoring for. So we need to make sure you're not stealing sick days, and we need to make sure that you're not goofing off. And I've been fascinated by how COVID has revealed the bullshit of it all by saying, look, everybody's working at home and work is getting done. So something is inherently wrong with your whole approach to it. But I wonder if we take that whole idea back to the library and access to the library and vocational awe, is there a way to look at how those all state are in conversation in controlling both the physical space of access and then motivating or driving the workers in that space at the same time? Is that, you see where I'm going here? Or am I just went off on a,
I think that COVID has been definitely an eye-opening for library workers in all the different types of libraries, public, school, academic, because the idea of the library building is so tied to library work. Oftentimes, when administrators and just people in general talk about the amazing things that the library does, it is most often the work of the librarians themselves. Right. However, we don't talk about, oh, this librarian helped me so much. It's, wow, the library does such good work. And so it erases the labor of the actual worker.
That's amazing.
To just, like, the worker is the library and the library is the building, right? It's not the library is also the worker. It's just that, like, the worker is the library.
Just like universities, right? The university.
But even more so, I think libraries are more associated with a building. I think there's a little bit more of a sense of faculty are standing in, well, because an individual faculty stands in front of a classroom and sort of does this thing.
But don't you think that the faculty labor is erased in the way that we talk about the university is the same way we talk about the library?
I mean,
the University of Oregon, which is just down the street from where we live, when we talk about that, it's a brand, it's an identity, it's all the brick buildings, it's the campus, it's the whatever.
Yes.
And the I know faculty believe that.
No. I know. And when kids get make their college tours and their choices, they never identify with faculty. They identify with the campus and the
The department.
But I just want to say one thing: there are TV shows about professors. There are no TV shows about librarians, far as I'm aware of.
I follow an unusual number of librarians on Twitter. Oh, yeah. I don't know why. Somehow I went down a path. Now, so I feel like librarians have a whole bunch of power, but I think it's not power, but the Twitter illusion. Like I live in the Twitter illusion, but yeah. I just think that's fascinating to how the language of that. You're absolutely right. It's just it's erased.
Did we cut you off? I apologize.
No, I think that to Kel's point that librarians love talking about libraries. Yeah. And so it can definitely seem like, especially on Twitter, that there's a lot of power in the library space. Yes, honestly, I think it's partly because of Karen's point in that there just isn't a lot of media and anything really about library workers. And so when we get anything, it's just like, oh my gosh, the library is being talked about, like let's like put all of our might behind it to support it. And so I think that to Karen's point, I think that when we think about faculty, there is a little bit more autonomy that faculty get that librarians and library workers don't get.
Right.
Oftentimes we'll be in academia, we'll be in the same union, and yet the rights that faculty will have are very different than the rights that librarians will have. Going back to the sick leave policy at Temple, again, we were both under TAUP, which is the faculty union. But if you think about what a faculty member does, they're on campus maybe 2 to 3 days a week for classes and office hours.
Mm-hmm.
And those other days, the expectation is that they're doing research or overseeing a lab or whatever it might be. The presenteeism, like the having to be physically in the building, definitely impacts librarians and library workers more than the faculty.
Right.
Those 2 or 3 other days where the faculty aren't on campus, they could be sick. I mean, you know, the idea is that they're doing work, but, you know, they could be using those days to go to the doctor, get their chemo, take their kids to a play or whatever it might be. Whereas library workers are expected to be the building again, right?
Exactly.
To be in the library, physically present, able to assist at any moment's notice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the biggest difference.
Right.
Yeah, the autonomy. I mean, there's no question.
I just want to loop back to this idea of vocational awe, right? So for the individual librarian, what are they taught, cooked in, fed, dripped?
Steeped in.
Steeped in, that's the word I'm looking for. That then, much like academics, pushes you toward that overwork,
self-sacrifice,
that vocational awe that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that it's the ideals of the library, those espoused values that libraries have, that we are the last democratic institution, the last non-capitalist institution. Mm.
That's a lot.
Yes, right. That pressure, that knowing that for our community, especially as libraries have become a catch-all for underfunded or unfunded social services, that if we aren't open, that those who are unhoused don't have a place to come in and have warmth, have shelter, have a place to access the internet. Without libraries, there are no spaces for children whose parents work 2 to 3 jobs and can't afford daycare or babysitters. The idea that for the elderly who need help with, I mean, whatever you name it, tax forms, mm-hmm. finding health information, all of this pressure that the library is the only space where you can go and not have to spend money in any way to be there. Because, mm-hmm. you know, we don't really have public parks anymore. Most green spaces are private property. Most spaces that require, you know, even to go to the bathroom, you need to pay in order to receive the key, whatever it might be. And so during library school and during all of these conferences, we are taught that we as librarians, as library workers, are basically upholding democracy itself. And so, again, when your whole job is meant to uphold the true democratic values of a nation, it can seem, again, petty or immoral to want to set healthy boundaries for yourself. I mean, even when we talk about the other side, the archive side, they are told that they're like the stewards of history, that without them doing the work, all will be lost to, you know, whatever it might be, to the ether. Mm-hmm. And so archives have, you know, decades long backlog that can realistically never really be tackled, because obviously history is happening every single day. But that idea, again, that if you don't spend every waking minute trying to make these documents, these monographs, whatever it might be, accessible, that this history will be lost forever. Again, it's hard to want to take a mental health day mm-hmm. or go on vacation knowing that all of this pressure is being put upon you.
Yeah.
So I have just one quick question, because then I think we'll have to wrap it up. Though I think a really important question we talk a lot about on the podcast and in our writing and with our just across the board about the significant additional emotional labor put on faculty of color, and especially Black faculty and especially Black women faculty. So if you have 10% of librarians are librarians of color, and the library is the last, quote unquote, the last democratic institution, and that you can don't have to pay to go to. Is there that also, are we looking at the same thing that we see in faculty of color?
100%. Again, speaking of LaTanya, one of the things that drew me to her immediately was the fact that, you know, Temple University is a university where a majority of the students are Black and Brown students. And yet in the library, only when I was there, it was just the two of us who were Black women. And in terms of people of color there, I don't think I would even have to go to two hands. That's mm-hmm. just how few librarians of color there were. And so this idea that it's a double-edged sword. One, students don't see us as authoritative. White students don't see us as authoritative. Oftentimes I'd get, where's the real librarian mm-hmm. sort of thing. But on the other hand, when we would have Black and Brown students come in, they would see us and know that we would understand the structural issues that they were going through in their classes. And so the amount of extra service work through mentoring, through just conversations, take up a lot more time than our white colleagues would be, mm-hmm. would understand, and even have the mental aptitude to talk about, really. Mm-hmm. And so it's that idea that we not only have the pressure of being, of upholding democracy, but as library workers of color, we have the added pressure of trying to break down the institutional barriers within the library that, of course, no one else either sees or wants to talk about. Because again, vocational awe says that if you critique, then that just means that you're not passionate enough or that you don't believe in the mission enough, whatever it might be. And so that added weight can just seem at times unbearable, really.
Wow. You have given us so much to think about. I really, really appreciate all of your work. I appreciate your being here with us today. I am so excited to see what you do next as you move forward in your PhD and beyond. So, Fobazi Itar, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you again for having me. I definitely look forward to doing more research on vocational awe and seeing how it affects not just the feminized fields, but even some of the fields that we don't necessarily think of, like tech. I mean,
right.
We can talk about Google for that's its own podcast, but I mean, it definitely shows that disconnect between the ideals, right? Google, it's their ideals are don't be evil or whatever, you know, it is basically.
Oops, they missed.
Yes, and the very different reality of working at Google, right, you know, right. Vocational awe, I think the most important thing to take away from it is that discrepancy between the ideals of the institution and what it actually means to work in it.
Yes.
Yes, right there.
Right there.
You
thank,
nailed it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
One last note here. This podcast is made possible every week by the exceptional work of our editor and producer, Stephanie Blair. If you happen to need audiovisual work, be sure you go check out baddieblair.com, BaddieBlair.com. And also, I encourage you to check out her phenomenal home decor and apparel designs, and you can check those out at chochochen.com, chochochen.com. As always, Stephanie Blair, we are grateful for your incredible talent. Thank you.